What? Truth and mercy. That's correct. Exactly right. And one more thing that it says they were lacking in. Knowledge. Okay, so there's three fundamental things they were lacking in. And so as a result, the people were doing what? A whole litany of sins in verse 2, chapter 4, if anybody has it. Not a very good list of things to be assigned to these people. Swearing, lying, killing, stealing, committing adultery. that's a litany of things that you would never want to hear discussed around your community, but yet that's the society in which they lived in. And what do we talk about as the root cause of the problems? And I pulled a few verses out of Amos as kind of a fast forward. We talked about the prosperity of the nation at that time, and we talked about the fact that Jeroboam II had restored much of the territory which they had lost through a period of time from the kingdom under Solomon during the divided kingdom, and he restored a lot of that. And we looked at some verses from 1 and 2 Kings that talked about that. And Amos, when you get over to Amos and pull out some of the verses that talk about the culture at the time, he says, "I will strike the winter house along with the summer house, and the houses of ivory shall perish." And there's some other verses that go along with it. That was Amos chapter 3, verse 15. Amos 4, 1 talks about some of the same sort of excesses and prosperity, and so does Amos chapter 6. But as you go through Amos, you know, and that's, of course, where our plan is to study that after Hosea, we'll get more into this lifestyle that they were indulging in. But that's part of the problem that they faced. They had so much, and they lacked knowledge. So when you couple these things together, when people get really comfortable and forget about God, this is kind of the end result. You kind of start living in your own way, making up your own rules. Then we talked about another part of the problem. And I pulled this verse from Isaiah. Of course, we did study Isaiah at length. And since they're writing at the same time, these books, these writers overlap, the works overlap. So you can go from one to the other and pull a lot of information together. But what was leading them away? Well, verse 15 says, "The elder and the honored man is the head, and the prophet who teaches lies is the tail." So that's talking about the whole leadership of the nation, essentially. And he says in verse 16, "For those who guide this people have been leading them astray, and those who are guided by them are swallowed up." So we're going to talk about that topic a little bit in more detail as we get into chapter 5, as he talks particularly to the leaders of the nation. So who put the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom, on this trajectory? We talked about that too on Sunday. Who was the first king of the divided kingdom in the north? Somebody said Jeroboam. Okay, so what kind of guy was Jeroboam? Well, what did he do? What was one of the first things he did as king? Right. You would have thought that they had learned their lesson during the wilderness. Somebody said, an historian said, "Those who ignore history are doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past." And that's exactly what is happening here. He set up golden calves for worship in Dan and Bethel. Dan being up in the north and Bethel in the south, so the people didn't have to go where? Right. He didn't want them slipping down to Judah and going to the temple. So he wanted to to kind of control all of that. So he did. And set up altars to the idols, to the Baals, and a variety of seductive worship that we read about in chapter 4.
And 1 Kings, one of the reasons why Jeroboam did that was because he didn't want the people going back to Judah and themselves with the kingdom of Judah.
Right, right. So, yeah, he was trying to control the population in that sense, as Terry was bringing out. Going back and reviewing verse 14 in chapter 4, he says, I will not punish your daughters when they commit or play the whore, nor your brides when they commit adultery, for the men themselves go aside with prostitutes and sacrifice with cult prostitutes. So the picture you get is that there's a complete repudiation of responsibility on the part of husbands, fathers, priest, the king, the household of the king was also mentioned. And we're going to, again, as I said, chapter 5, we'll pinpoint more of this again. Now, this is the cycle of the nation that we talked about in Isaiah. This is what Daniel put together. He talked about the rebellion, as which we're talking about now, the retribution, and then a restoration and the call to repentance that you see in Isaiah many times and see also in the book of Hosea and again in the book of Amos. So who was the, before I put the slide up, who was the kingdom or which kingdom was sent to destroy the northern kingdom? Assyria, okay. In about what year, just kind of refresh ourselves. Well, that was the southern kingdom. The number's good for the southern kingdom, but for the northern,
723 BC.
That's spot on. I was going to say 722, but we're not going to split hairs. That's correct. So that's the retribution phase. Now, what had to happen, or what was going to happen between that destruction of the entire nation and the restoration that would come years later? What would happen to the people? I ask the question a different way. Right. They were going to be scattered all over the Assyrian Empire. They're going to lose their homes and be taken captive. And we talked about the fact that Hosea refers to it as being taken back to Egypt, but not to the king of Egypt, but the king of Assyria. In other words, back into bondage where they started the whole journey. And that's, again, that's in chapter 11 that we looked at. Okay, just a question. I don't want to get too off track here from Hosea, but what happens to the nations that God summons to execute this retribution for Assyria, for example? Does God send them a thank you card for doing my work?
They usually get destroyed.
Yeah. Right, that's exactly what happened. You go to Isaiah, you get a clearer picture of what happens to Assyria, or what God is thinking about Assyria, although they do his bidding at his time. But what happens to Assyria? They get wiped off the face of the earth too, don't they? By whom? By which other great nation? I think Hannah had it in her mind a while ago when she said 586, but... Okay, Assyria is wiped out by whom? Exactly. So Babylon takes over and wipes them out. And then who takes care of Babylon? There's a little hint right there. You see it in Isaiah chapter 13. The Medes and then / the Persians. So they wipe out Babylon. What about the nation of Israel? Now we look back in Exodus chapter 19. What was the original intent when God took them out of slavery through the Red Sea, gave them the law through Moses? What was the intent?
Nation.
Right, exactly. So to be holy nation, and he also used the phrase a royal priesthood. So what was the result then? You compare Exodus 19 with Hosea chapter 4. That was the intent on the right-hand side. You shall be my treasured possession. And the people said after that, we will do all that you say. And look at the end result in Hosea chapter 4. Instead of that, they're swearing, lying, murder, all the things that list that we went through. Israel had become what is called, coined the phrase, I guess you might say, in Hosea, a harlot. And Hosea was asked to do what? In chapter 1. This is kind of a review of the first one or two lessons. I'm just trying to capture all this before we get into chapter 5. Right. He married a woman of harlotry, it says. Now, H.E. may have asked this question, but I want to ask it again. Was it the woman he married, Gomer, was she a harlot before he married her, or was she sort of a woman who became that because of the influence of the society?
Just your thought. Well,
I think she was, because it says, go take yourself and wife of the harlot.
Well, there's two schools of thought, two ways to look at it. And I look at it from the point of view that given what you read in chapter 2 and on through chapter 4 and beyond that, that she may have been sort of classified of that because the whole country was called a harlot. And it could be that she was considered sort of the, what do you say, average girl or average citizen within this nation. She was not unusual, and that was that's the influence, perhaps. No hard and fast rule there, but just something to think about. And then in this so-called marriage, they had three children, and do we remember the names of the three? The first starts with J?
Jezreel.
Okay. And the second is Lo Ruhama, which means what? Anybody recall? No mercy. And then Lo Ami was the third, which means what? Not my people. Okay. So, the names had a lot of significance back in those days. Even Hosea means salvation. We talked a little bit about the names of the prophets. Now, the names of these three children are significant. The marriage itself is significant. And it has, it's an analogy. It's a parallel to what the entire nation is going through. Again, the three names. And one quick question. Notice in your text that in verse 3 it says that Gomer conceived and bore him a son. And of course, it's talking about Jezreel. Now she had a daughter. The second child was a girl, so it's Lo Ruhama. And then the third, as we mentioned, was Lo Ami. It was another son. Now, notice that the text, at least in my text, in my version, it does not say in the second, third child that she bore him a son. So some people think that's significant. Some of the commentaries I looked at, some of the scholars think that's significant in the fact that she was having these affairs while they were married. And then what is Hosea charged to do? As you get into chapter 3, he's charged to marry Gomer. They have three children. And then there's a pause in the marriage story in chapter 2. Then you get back to Hosea, the prophet himself. And he's charged to do what? Well, he's charged to bring her back. If you look at verse 1, it says, "And the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins." Do you think this is the same woman as in chapter 1? Is this his wife it's talking about, Gomer? Not a trick question, just... I think it is, and the reason I think it is because of the picture that you see in chapter 2, that the entire nation is considered a harlot, but yet it says that God is going to call them back and entice them back with sweet words. He said in verse 19 of chapter 2, "Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and justice, loving kindness and mercy." And so there is this, and also he says in verse 14, before I move on, it says, "Behold, I will allure her and will bring her into the wilderness and speak comfort to her." So this is God calling his people back. So in that parallel in chapter 3, I think that Hosea is asked to call her back after these affairs. Now, that's significant if the second, third children that they had, or second, third child that they had, was not Hosea's. And why is that significant? Well, I think it paints a picture. You really put yourself in the shoes of the prophet at this point and say, whether you're a husband or a wife, how would you feel if your spouse did these kind of things to you? What is the... And then in the chapter 3, in chapter 3 it says that he is to buy her back. And he said, so in verse 2 he says, "So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and one half homers of barley." So he's buying her back. What does that buying her back represent? Well, I think that's the word he is. But from what? Exactly. That was exactly what I was thinking about. He's bringing her back, so he is like buying her out of slavery. And isn't that exactly what sin does to us? We're enslaved by sin. So that's the picture I think he's painting here for us. Here you have this whole nation that's mired in sin, and you have this prophet who marries a woman, she goes off and does all these adulterous things, and he buys her back out of slavery. So I think that's the picture that, or the analogy that we get from this. Okay. So the last question again, what was the intent of all this turmoil, the story about the prophet, his marriage and his children buying her back? Well, again, I think it's to put, it really puts us in the position of trying to understand how he felt. And if you understand how he felt, we can understand maybe a little bit more how God felt or how God viewed such a situation. How would a typical person that you know, and maybe if you're married, put yourself in his situation, say, well, what would you do? What would an average person do in this situation, with this kind of story, this kind of scenario? Would you tend to hate the person? A lot of people would. There's nothing worse than an adulterous affair. And the separation that it causes. Of course, in this story, Hosea is trying to bring her back. And that's a highly unusual thing to happen, is it not? How many people would do that? I mean, just think about your friends that you know, married. I've seen people who, my wife cheated on me, she's out. Or my husband cheated on me, he's out. Immediately, that's the end of the story, completely. And I would say, I don't know. 90% of the people that are in that situation, maybe 99% would say, that's it. You know, we're done. What does it say about God? What is the characteristic that the story is trying to get us to think about God? Right. Is that not God's mercy? His love? His promise? These people are totally failing. We put up the parallel of what they were supposed to be to what they became, and yet God is still working with them. Put yourself in God's place. If I were a God, and I said, and I made it this clear, so clear to a nation of people, and say, these are the rules. If you break them, they deserve what? Death. So it talks about God's patience, His mercy, His love.
We see that when Moses went back time and time again, talking to God, give him another chance.
Right. And spent 40 days pleading with God to save him, didn't he?
Yeah.
So, to me, that's an amazing story. I think that's maybe the takeaway from the story of Hosea. Now, after chapter 3, you don't go back and hear about his marriage again. You just kind of move on. And you have some repetition of what the nation was going through, the retribution that was coming. And then toward the end of the book, you get back into this restoration story. But I'm just totally impressed. When I had more time to think about Hosea and his marriage and the fact that perhaps his two of his three children were so-called aliens, as they're called later in the book. I didn't make that up. That's in later in Hosea. You become more, I think, impressed, or you have the impression that God's mercy and His grace and His loving kindness to tolerate this. Now, what I mean by tolerate is the remnant that we'll talk about later. Now, did everybody get a free pass? Did he forgive everyone? No. But he saved the nation for a purpose, a very important purpose, because it was to fulfill his promise, but he fulfilled it through whom? And we'll talk a little bit more about this later. Well, yeah, but I'm talking about at this particular time, and we talked about it in Isaiah, that R word, that remnant, right? Okay. Okay, now let's get over to chapter 5, and I put up the first few verses because I think the significance of the audience at this point. So let me just read through chapter 5, and we'll pause and make a few comments and maybe look at some of the, well, maybe 5 and 6, if I have the voice to do it. Okay. All right, beginning in verse 1, chapter 5. Hear this, O priest. Pay attention, O house of Israel, give ear, O house of the king, for the judgment is for you. For you have been a snare to Mizpah and a net spread upon Tabor. And the revolters have gone deep into slaughter, but I will discipline all of them. I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hidden from me. O now, O Ephraim, you have played the whore. Israel is defiled. Their deeds do not permit them to return to their God, for the spirit of whoredom is within them, and they know not God. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Israel and Ephraim shall stumble in his guilt. Judah also shall stumble with them. With their flocks and herds they shall go to seek the Lord, but they will not find him. He has withdrawn from them, and they have dealt faithlessly with the Lord. For they have borne alien children. And I think that's a reference going back to Hosea and his family situation. Now the new moon shall devour them with their fields. Blow the horn in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah. Sound the alarm at Beth-Aven. We follow you, O Benjamin. Ephraim shall become a desolation in the day of punishment among the tribes of Israel. I make known what is sure. The princes of Judah have become like those who move the landmark. Upon them I will pour out my wrath like water. Ephraim is oppressed, crushed in judgment because he was determined to go after her filth. But I am like a moth to Ephraim and like dry rot to the house of Judah. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to the great king, but he is not able to cure you or heal your wound. But I will be like a lion to Ephraim and like a young lion to the house of Judah. I will tear and go away. I will carry off and no one shall rescue. I will return again to my place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face, and in their distress earnestly seek me. Well, how earnestly are they going to seek him? We'll go to chapter 6. It says, "Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us, that he may heal us. He has struck us down, he will bind us up. After 2 days he will revive us. On the third day he will raise us up, that we may live before him. Let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. His going out is sure as the dawn. He will come to us as the showers, as the spring rains that water the earth." Verse 4, "What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Your love is like a morning cloud, like the dew that goes early away." Now maybe I should have paused at verse 3 and said, how sincere do you think that the words of the people that they're saying to the Lord are sincere? Well, verse 4 kind of answers that question, doesn't it? It reminds me of the passage in James chapter 4 about people who were praying, but their prayers were amiss and they didn't get their prayers answered because they were praying out of their own desires, perhaps. And I think that's the picture that's being drawn here, that there's no sincerity in these words. You might say, use the term too little, too late. Let's go on to verse 5. It says, "Therefore I have hewn them by the prophets. I have slain them by the words of my mouth, and my judgment goes forth as light. For I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings." Now I'll pause there. Now what does this mean to us? "For I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings." How does that apply to us? And what is the prophet saying, or what is God saying through the prophet right here? Is he saying he didn't want sacrifices? Now, if we put this in our time frame, in this dispensation, can we say something like, well, God wants me to love, so I really don't need to be part of a congregation, I don't need to show up for the Lord's Supper, I don't need to sing or whatever. Is that what God's saying? That we don't need to worship as intended? Or that's not important? Well, I think it's a matter of motive and what creates the worship. What's inside of the heart? Right? Verse 7, it says, "But like Adam, they transgressed the covenant. There they dealt faithlessly with me. Gilead is the city of evildoers, tracked with blood, and as robbers lie in wait for a man, so the priests band together. They murder on the way to Shechem. They commit villainy. In the house of Israel have seen a horrible thing. Ephraim's whoredom is there. Israel is defiled. For you also, Judah, a harvest is appointed when I restore the fortunes of my people. Okay, so right here at the end of all this doom, there is a word called restore, and the message or the hint is something is God's going to restore the people or the nation in some way, and we'll find out in what way later as we go through the study. So let's pause there for a moment and go to lesson 4 in the booklet and go through some of the questions. Maybe that kind of help pull some things together. And it says in the intro on lesson 4, page 9 in your workbook, it says, Hosea begins here by calling the priest, the king, and the people to pay close attention to his previous warning. He continues by stressing the doom that is certain in turning from God. Okay. So the first question would be, to whom does God's judgment pertain?
Well, you covered all bases, didn't you?
He addresses the priests, the kings, and the people.
Yes. So from top to bottom.
All the ranks of society.
Right, exactly. What type of spirit, and I like these series of questions in number 2, what type of spirit had Israel developed, and how would this make repentance difficult? And it says compared to Ephesians 2 and Romans chapter 1, verse 28. So first of all, what kind of spirit had they developed? Yeah, exactly. And it makes me think about the passages over in that Paul uses in Romans chapter 8, you know, being filled with what? Being filled with the Spirit. We're going to be filled with something. And that something in their case was the spirit of harlotry. So what made their repentance difficult, do you think? Anybody have a thought? There are some verses over in chapter 4 that says, the more they increase, the more they sinned against me, and I would change their glory into shame. And then it talks about, in verse 11, harlotry, wine, and new wine enslave the heart. So what is that a picture of? What would you call that in one word? And addiction, right? So the people have become so accustomed and so addicted to their lifestyle, their excesses, their wine, their foods, everything about the culture. Right, exactly. There is progression that has become so excessive that it corrodes and kills the heart, and people begin hating God and everything that God is all about. And number 3, why would they be unable to find God?
From the text in chapter 5. Verse 6.
Yes, yes. God, it says God has withdrawn from them. So it has become to the point where they weren't drawn to God, so God's pulling back from them. Exactly. Okay, number 4 says, use the example of Gomer to explain the meaning of strange children, verse 7. Now, my verse 7 in the version that I read said, alien children. So your version may say strange children. So again, you have the parallel of Hosea and his marriage, God and his relationship with his people, and what do you see? You see the spirit of harlotry in the people. Hosea marries a woman who is either, she was a harlot when he married her, or became a harlot. And then the two children that they had, maybe perhaps, two of the children that they had together, or not together, were of the adulterous relationship that they were that she had. Okay, why was Ephraim crushed and oppressed? I had verse 11 on that one. Any thoughts? I came out with that because he was willingly, but he walked by human precept, by his own principles, is why they were crushed and oppressed. And number 7, to whom did Ephraim turn when in trouble? Right, Assyria, and also mentioned the nation of Egypt. God would become as what to Ephraim and Judah? In verse 14. He says, I will be like a lion to Ephraim and like a young lion to the house of Judah. I will tear them and go away, and I will take them away, and no one shall rescue. Now, any thoughts about why he says like a lion to Ephraim and a young lion to the house of Judah? Why the difference? Any difference between the big lion and the little lion? I don't know if there's any significance in that, except perhaps that Ephraim was so corrupt and so thoroughly corrupt that he uses that sort of difference in the lion versus the young lion. And,
characterized his 12 sons near the end of Genesis in different parishes. And to Judah, he compared Judah as a young lion, as something strong and adamant.
Right.
That's where the young lion part comes in. And Jacob lessened the 12 person and various ones in here, characterizing their future.
Okay. All right.
Okay, all right, going on to chapter 6, number 9, it says verse 1 through 3, or the appeal of Hosea, or the insincere sayings of the people, they reflect the true nature of God. We talked about that just a little bit, that it seems like there were impulsive whims and a passing thought, because they were really more worried about what than the spirituality and the relationship with God. More about their crops, their houses, their vineyards. Let's go into number 11. Describe the goodness of Ephraim and Israel. Why was Ephraim so pinpointed in this text? Over and over it talks about Ephraim. Well, quickly, if you go back and look at Jeroboam the first, what tribe was he of? Well, we find that he was the son of Nebat and Ephraimite. So over and over it talks about Ephraim as sort of the symbol of the entire nation of Israel. So I think that's why he pinpoints Ephraim and points him out, is because Jeroboam, who put him on this track, was an Ephraimite. What did God truly desire? And we'll stop on this question. It wasn't purely sacrifice. So what was it? Right. I would say so. That and a true heart, true love, true desire to serve him as he had promised to bless the people. Okay, we'll stop there for tonight and pick up on lesson five next time, which is chapters 7 and 8.